reach for. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA. This way, and he's fighting for democracy or fighting for the red. He says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, in a war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him, and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. Those of you who are regular listeners know that my wife and I lost one of our pet rats a couple of weeks ago. She died after a short illness. Well, we bought a new one so that our other remaining one wouldn't be so lonely without her friend Ginger. The new one is named Pepper. She's a beautiful mix of brown and white. The others that we had were all white. Pepper is very sweet, a nice addition to our family. You know, the two-legged rats, the ones that are staging their popularity contest over the next couple of weeks, they're not so nice. They seem like the sort you wouldn't want to be alone with. You know, a dark alley, all that. You know, well, you know, if they weren't so rich, they'd probably be the type that would be running up to your car as you drove through certain parts of most cities. They'd be each one trying to top the other one saying, "Hey, man, I got the real stuff. I got the big one." Each one would be threatening you that the other guy was a fake. The cops are just down the street. I suppose saying that Romney and Obama are like those street dealers might be insulting. But I don't think it's the politicians that I'm insulting. I rode my bike past the Wilton Manor City Hall a couple of days back. That's the closest place where I could vote early. Line was too long for me. I came home, immediately requested an absentee ballot. There's a lot of local issues here. I hope my vote may actually count on some of them. For the so-called big event, I'm going to vote for Jill Stein. Our monthly columnist, Sherwood Ross, has been conducting an informal exit poll down in his Miami neighborhood. He already voted. He'll be sharing the results in his column tonight, so be sure to stick around and listen to that. Lee Herrick will be returning to our show tonight, telling us about her new book and reading from it. We always love the way that she makes poetry into a performance art. We have a new American dream. We dare to hope, to pray, and to work for a world where people are helping each other and loving each other instead of hurting each other and hating each other. We're looking for a new ride. Here's Bill Hicks.
It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
I'm Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream radio show, and we welcome you. Now I'm going to turn the show over to my friend and co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. As you mentioned, tonight we welcome special guests Lee Herrick in Minneapolis and Sherwood Ross in Coral Gables, Florida. And so tonight we're gathering together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Minneapolis, Coral Gables, and wherever you are. Paul Wellstone died 10 years ago last Thursday, October 25th, 2002. A book I would like to recommend to get the truth about that day is American Assassination by Jim Fetzer. Another documentary that I'd like to recommend would be by Snowshoe Films, and it's called Wellstone, They Killed Him. Lee Herrick, our first guest tonight, gave me permission to read from her website some of her reflections about Wellstone, about the beginnings of the war in Iraq, and how she came to write her most recent book, Homefront. But first, I'd like to mention and just read a little bit from an article by Paul Lendman. It's on Veterans Today. It's called Paul Wellstone, 10th Anniversary of His Assassination. It goes this way. October 25th marked the 10th anniversary of Wellstone's death. Was it accidental or an assassination to silence a sadly missed principled voice? Convincing evidence suggests foul play. Anyone with a powerful public voice supporting principles he embraced could end up targeted for elimination and kill. That's how rogue states operate. Bucking the system risks life and limb. Wellstone paid the ultimate price. Based on all relevant evidence, we must conclude that the theory that Wellstone was assassinated is far more probable than the official story that doesn't wash. And that's Paul Lendman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N. Go to Veterans Today, Paul Wellstone, 10th anniversary of his assassination. And this is Lee Herrick's account, a part of it anyway. And you can read the full at her website, Lee Herrick. 2002 was a terrible year if you weren't pumped up to see Americans engage in yet another war. While Bush, too, was ramping up his rhetoric to do just that, the U.S. lost two important and critical voices against the war, the poet June Jordan and Senator Wellstone, who died with seven others, including his wife Sheila, a champion of human rights dedicated to bringing attention to and ending domestic violence, and their daughter Marcia. Wellstone's plane mysteriously crashed 2 miles from the Eveleth Airport in Minnesota. If I had been disappointed by Wellstone casting his vote for the Patriot Act, I was relieved he remained the ever-progressive hero by voting nay when it came to going to war with Iraq. In the 2002 Senate race, Wellstone would have tipped congressional power on the side of Democrats. Just days away from the Senate election, with Wellstone favored to win, his plane went down. It was a JFK moment. I remember where I was, how I looked at my husband, how my stomach turned, how I had that sinking, sickening feeling, that instinctual sense that told me no accident had occurred. It was quite unbelievable indeed. and right under our noses, the NTSB would eventually provide additional fiction, and it would go down well on the outside. But in the living rooms of privacy, we all knew better. It was made to be finished. Bush had his way. I remember believing, as I attended protest rallies in St. Paul and Washington, D.C., as we edged nearer, then entered into engagement, I remember believing, as I walked the Lake Street Bridge with other activists, as I got my Say No to War with Iraq sign, I remember actually believing those of us who wished to do so would actually stop Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld. We would keep U.S. troops from having to engage in a war whose need was entirely steeped in a fiction formed of lies, and we would save the people in Iraq from having to endure further suffering beyond sanctions through the oncoming American military might that would lethally pose as and otherwise utterly displace effective foreign policy. But the propaganda campaign was effective, and most Americans chose to believe it was just to send our troops into war. There was talk about just war. Opinions abounded, and critical thinking landed dead, vilified in the vociferous arena of public opinion, and there was nothing I could do. American troops would be sent off to defend the home front. The home front would be a land in which I felt myself a stranger. Everything I believed in, everything I trusted about my country, my government, my Congress, was thrust into the vacuity of the military-industrial complex, spinning its illusions through its spokesman with such skill that much of public talk was not thought but wrote. And with the wounds of the missing Senator Paul Wellstone hardly healed, the invasion of Iraq was salt in the festering scab of that terrible loss of a committed public servant. When Wellstone died, we went to his campaign headquarters on University Avenue, where flowers and signs lay in mounds, where messages were written out on large makeshift cards and candles burned in votives. The people walked by one another silently, some weeping softly. We did not greet each other, though we seemed to hold our vigil and appreciation as something sacred in silent presence and witness of. I was stunned by the breadth of Wellstone's reach across communities. I took notes without intention beyond the understanding I would take note. As we, the mournful, the grieving, paid our respects, we did so in great quietude. We seemed to understand what had happened. There was no talk of shock as during 9/11, no questioning, no wondering why. There was only the pall of silence that falls over the conscience when it perceives grave danger. When the first bombs of the shock and awe campaign started dropping on Baghdad on March 19, 2003, I fell into a state of demoralization that lasted 2 years. I stopped believing in the impact of activism. I stopped asserting, like Natalie Maines, that a First Amendment right is of no use if one does not exercise it. I remember being struck at the time, utterly struck with the notion of defeat, that the war machine was in place, its mentality overwhelmingly subscribed to by American citizens, and I felt with painful acuity there would never be another moment in history where we might escape the ideas described by Gore Vidal as in perpetual war for perpetual peace. I became entirely disheartened. I had failed to internalize the great Buddhist proverb, show up, tell the truth, don't be attached to an outcome. I was attached, very, so I sank. I withdrew from most public engagement and fell deeply into creation, the cosmic method of survival, and ultimately my greatest act of hope imagined. During this time, I completed the Poems of Homefront, produced my Just War CD, and continued writing so that by 2005 I had accomplished the second manuscript. And from this time, that began with the Hanging Chads in Ohio. From this time, whose bitter disappointments had their temporary way with me, I learned to deal with expectation. I learned to steer my energy toward focused purpose and to guard that purpose, as Gandhi taught, in such a way that prevents my vital energy from being sucked into the void of apathy and rancor, lending it instead toward balance by way of conserving the energy of anger and transforming it into constructive use. So it is, I will hope for this world, this brave new world that has such people in it. And that's part of Lee Herrick's reflection on her website. That's from her telling about Wellstone and also about her thought process and creative process in creating the book that she will join us just in a few moments here to read from Homefront, Poems of the Bush, 2 Years. Okay, back to you, Chuck.
Tonight's show is sponsored in part by the good folks at Shop and Plop, indoor porta-potties for the busy Christmas shopper. We know soon you'll be on the run all day long, round and round in circles, buying stuff to keep your favorite Americans happy, but sooner or later you're going to need a pit stop. Why not? Shop and Plop. Shop and Plop. Take some time out to sit in your own little world, inches from the hurried masses around you, brushing against the wall while you hold on tight. You hear their conversations, who's a bitch, who shot what, while you search in the dark for the paper roll, hold on to both walls, wondering if some teenage swarm might decide to tip you over, reach out your foot to touch all your expensive hard-won packages to make sure your whole day, your whole life wasn't wasted. You smile, it's all good. Then you hear a satisfying plop in the communal goo, and you're ready to continue, to push on, persevere in your pursuit of the American dream. You emerge refreshed, victorious, join your fellow Americans, some standing in line glaring at you, some rushing past brandishing razor-sharp elbows. You smile. For a moment, you pause to adjust those heavy bags cutting into your arms, and you nod knowingly, now realizing for perhaps the first time with such clarity why we killed all those millions of Indians and those millions of Iraqi children and all those poor people in Afghanistan. You step down as a lady from your throne, from a throne, as the next person takes your hand to allow you to set your blistered foot once again on the top of the mall tile floor. You gracefully bend your leg to pull the paper from your shoe. You smile at the waiting line as a movie star to her adoring fans. Shop and Plop, the American way to go. Look for the handy blue and yellow plastic huts in the middle of the mall.
And now I'd like to welcome our first guest, Lee Herrick. Lee Herrick is a poet, writer, and recording artist whose work has been anthologized and widely published in print and electronic journals. She's a two-time Pushcart Prize nominee. Her most recent book is Homefront, Poems of the Bush, 2 Years, and it's just been released in October 2012. Hello, Lee. How are you doing? Hello, Lee.
Hello.
Lee, how are you?
I'm fine, Mike. Nice to be here again.
You betcha. Nice to hear your voice. I just introduced you, if you didn't hear that, and the time now, you've got about 10, 15 minutes, and just take it away.
Okay. So, well, thanks for reading that memorial that I did for Wellstone. That definitely evokes a lot of sad feelings in me, but... yeah, I appreciate that. So I am going to read from Homefront, and since we're right on the heels of Sandy, Hurricane Sandy, I'm going to start with a poem called Global Edge. Perhaps we will get out of this. Perhaps at this corner, this edge, this high story in art and time, perhaps. Perhaps we will manage it as we have managed myths and moons, as we have managed our contentments and resentments, perhaps. As we have managed our depressions and elations, our limiting loves and precious hates, perhaps, perhaps. Or perhaps the moon will last us out, perhaps. In the dying of the dying times. Perhaps the sun will wait to warm what will come post-human or human again, more human perhaps, as it calls to us from the future, demanding we determine now the degrees of what will be. second poem I'm going to read is called Lost, Mostly Found Poem. But the children, but for the children, hundreds and thousands and no idea, a young and largely illiterate, savvy to the streets sort of new society borrowed in boots twice the size, but not like our own, no, never like our own, except in pockets of buried American poverty, children who know these pages without plumbing, this alphabet without electricity, these decades of basic needs, mostly unvaccinated, without ideas, without any plans, whose words, poor refugees, come largely unskilled, falling like snow in the camps of Afghanistan. The third poem is Dream Number Two. And in the dream, he looked like Charlton Heston, like George W., looked like anyone intent on keeping, and he was keeping her, and he was building a home in a gated community, which would be hidden, which would be unlike a community on a hill. And she was kept locked and up and under key, and he was surveying his property, but didn't know the dream routes of just windows or ways, of just waiting for one just opportunity. He didn't know she was full of will, able to look into the keeper's eyes, able to question any state of perpetuity from which she would crawl and head toward the streets intent as all the endless witnesses choosing to do nothing, though a woman ran among them, screaming until she woke. This is called Cornucopia. Aren't there truffles enough in general and for the gendarmes du monde not to be trifled with? Isn't there enough corn and wheat, enough beef and beer, enough milk and soy, enough entertainment, enough football and showgirls, roses for mom and the biggest diamond rings for those we love? Isn't there enough? Isn't there? In the sugar cane sweets of the bambooed mornings, in the teed up hot afternoons of summer, in the dusk of setting sun emblazoned capped Midwestern peaks of want and need, able to be satisfied in weekly vacation packages, if you are one of the fortunate given half a chance, who will you face in the world's next crisis? From where will your next letter come? This warm bed in winter, who will die for it again? And then, since you started with the Wellstone writing that I'd done, I'm going to end with the poem I ended up writing after taking those notes that I did while we were there at his office. And so this is called Memorial, University Avenue, St. Paul, the last poem. Last night, the wax of war still dripping, still running everywhere, running in streets and highways, running through deserts and forests, mountains and fields, along the back roads and alleys and near the unnamed creeks of infamy. Last night through living rooms and salons and local cafes, running through speakers and headsets and the minds of those who are afraid. Last night, among so many candles lit and going out or out at last. Last night, as the wax of war ran on in Jenin and Ramallah, in Baghdad and Jakarta, last night in Moscow and Bali, in Manila and Florida, last night in New York City, and from under the Lake Street Bridge, running and dripping, forming together in pools that solidify like men in the school of the Americas. Last night, as war waxed on, immersed in the floods and tricklings of its ever-specified mentality, last night, the Ethiopians said goodbye. Latino union workers said goodbye. The deaf community said goodbye. Last night, the Red Lake Band, the veterans, the Center for Victims of Torture, the Class of 97 said goodbye. Last night, in the ways human bodies will, because of wars that have little or everything to do with them, flowers lay in piles on the sidewalk and clinging to the chain link fence. Last night, in the silence and the flicker of one life here, one life gone, hope came out from waiting where it always stands, between the flowers and the flames, between the guilty and the blameless, between letters and words and people holding hands or nothing at all. Last night, in the shadows and the cold, where people stood against the shadows, last night in the cold, such silences exhumed all knowledge of flames, the brief candle, who here, who suddenly gone, who so able to be lain as flowers now lay, strewn about the sidewalks of testimony that would tell in many languages, construct a meaning able to serve when asked, what has happened? What is happening now? As wars that have everything and nothing to do with them wax on around a world whose hope waits quietly between the flowers and flames, between the candles and messages, between the human and the inhumane, the steady stream, the hot tear, the one heart, fragile, whispering in all of us, wanting to know, what, in your grief, will you say you are witnessing?
Thank you very much, Lee.
Oh, you're welcome.
Can you tell us once more, or just kind of outline how people can get your book and tell us again the title?
The title is Homefront. Subtitle, Poems of the Bush 2 Years. I will be reading, I'm doing various readings around Minneapolis. The best way to find out or to keep up with me is to go to my website, leeherrick.com, and check out my calendar. But the first one that's on the schedule right now is November 20th at 7:30. It's a group reading, but I will be reading from the book. The book will be available for sale, along with the CD, Just War. That's at 7:30 at the University Club in St. Paul. We're going to do another launch, probably just a book sale post-Thanksgiving, in my husband's studio, who we collaborated on some of on this project that we call Just War. But anyway, some of his graphite drawings are in the book, so he's going to open his studio sometime. So again, just people check out my calendar, and all that will eventually be posted on the calendar.
Very cool, very cool. And to purchase the book, you do what?
To purchase the book, you can go to my website right now and just contact me. So eliminating the middleman.
Okay.
It kind of saves cost, you know. So, yeah. So just contact me. If you're in continental U.S., I'll send you a book, and the book is $14, and it's plus tax, comes about $15, and it's $2.97 for shipping. So there you are.
And the website is do I have that right, leeherrick.com?
Yep, leeherrick.com.
LEIGHHERRICK.com.
Yep, that's
Thank
it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lee. You have a good night. Thanks for
All
coming
right,
on.
All right, thanks a lot. You bet. Happy to do it.
Yep. Good night.
Good night.
Tonight's bedtime story is called The Revenge of the Bedbugs, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. That means that anyone interfering with factory farms where pigs and other animals are crowded together in pens and pretty much driven crazy because pigs are not stupid, anybody interfering with that is a terrorist. Now, after we bloat the animals with toxins and drive these intelligent animals crazy, we drive them into a big building and we slice their throats, hang them from chains by their legs, cut them up, and then we eat them. Recently, a truck driver for an Ohio packing plant found a document apparently written by the pigs whom he had just taken in for slaughter. It was written on nice animal stationery. Set on top, four legs good, two legs bad. Truck driver scanned down the paper, saw some big words. He thought he'd better turn it in. He gave it to the slaughterhouse manager, who gave it to the manager of the cut floor, who passed it to the manager of the kill floor, who gave it right on back to the truck driver, who was out hosing the blood from his truck in the parking lot. Yeah, he sent it to his congressman, who made a law that anyone this smart who cared about it, every living creature this much, was nuts. To be charged with terrorism, and so they did that. They made the law to keep everyone safe from the smart ones who cared about every living creature. But by then, they were already dead. Now, have a good night. Don't let the angry bed bugs bite.
This message is brought to you by the Foundation for a New American Dream. Did we go to the moon? Maybe. Maybe not. But just like Voldemort and so many discussions that are prohibited in America, it is one that cannot be named. Was 9/11 an inside job? Stop! See? Like that. You can't talk about that. Was Paul Wellstone assassinated? A roll of the eyes. You are sent to Siberia by your brother, your mother, and your cousin. Disapparated from the Thanksgiving dinner table. Poof! No one can now see you or talk to you. You are a non-person. Might as well go smoke in the garage. Did FDR provoke Pearl Harbor in order to get into World War II? Did the government burn men, women, and children alive at Waco? Was the government involved in the Oklahoma City bombing? Are so-called terror plots and mass murder, such as in Aurora, Colorado, and dozens of other, quote, terrorist events, actually engineered by the FBI and CIA, NSA, in order to bring about a zeitgeist of fear and scare Americans into accepting a police state? What are chemtrails? What does the government know about UFOs? Why does Sirhan not remember anything about the Robert F. Kennedy shooting? Who shot Martin Luther King? James Earl Ray says he did not do it. Evidence says the FBI and others did it. Do those questions have merit or are they preposterous? We'll never know because Brian Williams and NBC and Amy Goodman and NPR are afraid of even the question. Why? Did Bush steal the elections of 2000 and 2004? Ask these questions on any mainstream or so-called liberal website or TV show or newspaper or radio show and you will get laughed down. Ask it on the so-called liberal progressive Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart shows. They will try to humiliate you. Why? Is it because you are truly so hilariously pathetic, or is it because they are so, so afraid? The Foundation for a New American Dream, because it's time to wake up. Your toast is ready. The bus is here. The world is on fire.
Our second guest tonight is our monthly columnist, Sherwood Ross. The shows featuring Sherwood are among the most popular of our shows because he's always got something very good to say, very interesting, and thoroughly researched. Sherwood Ross was born in Chicago, Illinois, got his BA from the University of Miami in Coral Gables, Florida, worked for the city of Chicago, that's her degree, receiving his BA in human relations. He was a speechwriter and press aide to Mayor Richard Daley. And he worked for the Chicago Daily News and the National Urban League. Worked for WAAF in Chicago, WOL in Washington. He's got an award for best spot news coverage of any Chicago radio station. Originated the famous Speak Up interview show for WOL. Well, those of you who know this show know how good he is, and right now we're glad to welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show, Sherwood Ross.
I thought you would all like a preview of how Florida will vote for president next Tuesday, so I went out and interviewed voters as they came out of the voting booth in the lovely suburb of Coral Gables. Coral Gables is a charming, upscale community on the western border of Miami. Probably you could call many homes in that city mansions. It has a famous shopping street called Miracle Mile, and it is the home to the University of Miami, a private institution that draws many of its students from Latin America. A great many refugees from Cuba live in the Miami area, and many who can afford to live in Coral Gables do so. So the voters in Coral Gables are wealthier and better educated than the general run of the population in South Florida. Early voting is being held at the Coral Gables Library, where I counted about 300 people standing in line both last Saturday and just the other day. The voters who brought folding chairs were the luckier because the waiting line to vote was about 3 hours long. Voting takes a while because there's so much more on the ballot than just the presidential election. The ballot is 9 pages long, and it takes voters some time to fill it out. The presidential election is right at the top, however, so voters can't miss it. Anyway, I decided that I would only interview people who were coming out of the polls and had already voted. They were easy to identify because after they voted, they got a small pasty label to put on their shirt or blouse saying, "I voted." Since the voters were anxious to get about their business as they emerged from the polls, I decided to ask them two quick questions. First, who did you vote for president? And second, who did you vote for president in 2008? I told them that I was a reporter and that I wasn't going to ask them their name or address, just the two questions. I was hoping to get a good sample of all age groups, but a lot of the elderly Hispanic-speaking voters did not want to be bothered or didn't want to tell a stranger how they voted. This means that the results I'm going to share with you are not perfectly reflective of the general population, but skewed somewhat toward younger voters. Now, you may wonder why I asked voters who they voted for in 2008. Well, that was to give me an idea of their party affiliation. I could then compare their 2008 vote with their 2012 vote to see if they had changed parties. That would tip me off as to whether there was a swing in progress toward either party. Example, some of you may have seen or read about General Colin Powell endorsing President Obama last week. He volunteered that he voted for Obama in 2008. That was an important vote for Powell, as he had been a lifelong Republican, so he was switching. When you see that happening, if it happens again and again in your sample, you can be pretty sure that the wave of defections is weakening one of the parties and that it may lose the election. Back in 2008, I went to the very same polling place in Coral Gables and interviewed folks who had just voted, and I found only a few Democrats who were switching to the Republican Party. But that year I found quite a few Republicans who were switching to the Democrats. The result was that Obama had a solid majority, and I could predict that he would carry Florida and maybe win the White House, which is how it came out. A lot had happened to make those Republicans change their mind. My guess is they held President Bush responsible for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the economy, and were hoping for a change. This week I found no such thing. Out of the 100 early voters I talked to, I only found 4 voters who switched parties. This was a middle-aged white male who had voted for Obama in 2008, but was disillusioned and had just cast his vote for Romney. But for every switch away from the Republicans, I found 2 voters switching away from Obama and the Democrats. The trend is definitely toward the Republicans in this election. Most Republicans were voting the Republican ticket, and most Democrats were voting the Democrat ticket. But what switching there was a switch from Democrats to Republicans. In the course of the interviews, I found that Obama has the youth vote pretty well sewed up. I interviewed 5 young people who had just voted for the first time in their lives, and 4 of them said they voted for Obama. And if you heard that President Obama has his problems with white male voters, you heard right. In my little sample, 45 of the voters were white males, and Romney got 25 of those 45. Obama just got 20. And if you heard that Obama does better reaching women, you also heard right. Of the 51 women who voted, 28 marked their ballot for Obama, and 23 marked their ballots for Romney. Overall, Obama got 52% of the early voters I interviewed, and Romney got 48%. One of the things I noticed was that if I asked some voters why they voted as they did, the younger voters gave more detailed explanations than the older ones, maybe because they were students. Talk about Obama's plans in an intelligent manner, and I found their responses refreshing. So what's my conclusion? Well, 4 years ago, I went to the same polling place a week before the election and interviewed early voters. Then, as now, I found the majority were for Obama, and I predicted Obama would carry Florida because I found so many Republicans had switched to him. This year, I find no such thing. I find voters voting along straight party lines and virtually no switching. And it seems to me that Obama's margin of victory in the Coral Gables precinct is much less this year than in 2008. So unlike 2008, when I predicted a landslide for Obama, I cannot do so this year. The election is close, very close, and if Obama wins, his margin likely will be smaller in Florida than 4 years ago. That's what the early voting tells me. The question here is, can Obama carry Florida with many fewer voters than he had 4 years ago? 4 years ago in Coral Gables, Obama had 67%. This year, he's only got 52%. 52%, that's a significant drop. And it makes me think that when the largely upstate Republican votes are counted, they may overwhelm Obama's narrow majorities in the South. So I'm going to say it's likely that Mitt Romney will get this important swing states, 29 electoral votes. I'm sure with Ross, reach me at ross10@gmail.com. And so, good night to every one of you.
Thank you, Sherwood, and good night.
Thank you. You have a good night.
This message is from Harper, Random, Collins, Bantam, Simon, Penguin, and Schuster, America's book publisher. You've heard of the Harry Potter series. Well, that author has retired, and that's left a big gap on the Walmart bookshelf. And we are pleased to announce the Killing Ben series by the Navy SEALs who did or will do the killing. We think you'll love the tales of terror, adventure, and terror. We think you will eat up Killing Ben Cohen and Killing Ben Affleck. There will be low-light bar scenes, fast fingers finding passwords on really cool computers, Tom Cruise running fast, Killing Ben Roethlisberger, Killing Ben Franklin, Killing Ben Stiller. There will be car crashes and people jumping out of fast pickups on country back roads with country music playing, animated jumping over mooses and squirrels. Killing Big Ben, Killing Ben Bernanke, Killing Ben Hogan.
There will be books and movies and coffee mugs, T-shirts and tiny toys inside of hamburgers. Killing Ben Stein, Ben Kingsley, Benjamin Netanyahu. Killing Benjamin Harrison, Benny Goodman, Ben Gazzara, and Uncle Ben's Rice. Look for the Killing Ben series in your Walmart aisle soon. How it was done by the Navy SEALs who were there, or will soon be there, in on the action, right up close. It's true. There'll be T-shirts. Killing Bo Peep. Killing Quasimodo. Killing Cruella. Killing Captain Hook.
Well, it's been another long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Along with all the election business, there has been a steady stream of burials at sea. And something else I wanted to talk about. Solomon Sendak, an unknown Mount Liberty rider, took off, was it last spring, in his green 76 Pontiac Bonneville on a tour around the country to sell his books, which he has self-published, and not even his wife or children know about the books, even though on several occasions he has told them that he has given all rights to his books and proceeds to them in his will. They just look up for a moment and grin and say, "Oh, Daddy," and go back to their phones. Solomon Sendak sent back accounts of his travels in columns he wrote for the local newspaper. He sent them by email, and they did not get printed. And when he returned and went to ask about that, the editor agreed to put them up now on the newspaper website in the local crime section whenever there is room.
Hello. I'm Solomon Sendak. I'm from Mount Liberty, Nebraska, and I'll soon be taking a country drive, a road trip, because our country seems on the verge of something bad. You know, I'm not trying to get away. My mother told me once that when they heard the War of the Worlds broadcast on the radio, they got in the car and just drove. Just to be going somewhere seemed to help, because they were so scared. They thought it was the end of the world. This time the fire. Well, I suppose I'm plenty scared. I'm trying to run towards the blaze, trying to see what I can do to put it out. I've written some books during the Bush-Obama era. I'm going on a book tour to promote my latest, The Complex Apartment. Before I leave, I'm also going to send a letter along with a tax form with a black magic marker X through it. It's a protest against George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and about a million other things. My book, The Complex Apartment, is a punch in the nose to Barack Obama, Dick Cheney, Joe Biden, George W. Bush, and Karl Rove. Somebody needs to punch those guys in the nose. They smirk while others die. Getting away with murder, robbing us blind. By sending off this crossed-out tax form, taking this drive around the country in my 76 green Bonneville with the driver's side window and radio that don't work, I feel I'm at least doing something. Because, well, can we say it out loud in public? Won't people think we're crazy? Won't they roll their eyes? Wouldn't it be easier to just talk about American Idol? People on Fox and the announcers on the radio, don't say this. They'd say it if it were true, right? Because
they, Bush and company, did 9/11 themselves. They killed Paul Wellstone. They sent the anthrax. They lied about WMD. They stole two presidential elections. They would never have told us on their own about Abu Ghraib. They have secret torture prisons around the world that we were never meant to find out about. They spy on us, and not because of terrorism. They steal the oil. They want power. They want to be rich. They could care less about us, about the soldiers, about the freedom of the Iraqi or Afghanistan people. They snicker about all that in the back room. Sure they do. There's more. Barack Obama knows about it. Many of our news media professionals are actually professional propaganda ministers for this cabal. Who cannot wonder about Fox, Tom Brokaw, Rush Limbaugh, and Dan Rather in this regard? It sure seems that way. What's that expression about walking and sounding like a duck?
I was in second grade when our principal, Sister Ellen, walked into the room just after lunch recess. She said the president had been shot. A few years later, I went to sleep wondering if Bobby would make it through the night. And, of course, they'd killed Martin Luther King 2 months before. So, now in my 50s, those my age, to do anything to really understand what happened during those few minutes after lunch in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963. My kids grow up wondering what really happened on September 11, 2001. Perhaps none of us will ever know. They keep the truth locked away, marked to be open after we're all dead. The rest they strike out with a giant black magic marker. But the Bush family is in power, as are the Obamas. And American oil companies recorded record profits last year. The world turns. They want power. They want to be rich. Human traits, human desires, quack. The American dream. You look outside your window, you see robins and squirrels and Snickers wrappers and Labrador poop. Fair to partly cloudy. It's all a fairy tale. You're a living character inside of a children's book with dragons and monsters and evil kings and queens. How did we come to this? We have fake history. Our junior high school history books should be all in italics, presented with a wink by the teacher handing out textbooks on the first day of school. Remember the Maine. Pearl Harbor, Gulf of Tonkin, Iran-Contra, Waco, OKC, moon landings, Watergate, stolen elections, millionaires in Washington, D.C., who spend long days agonizing over the lives and living conditions of dump truck drivers and nurses' aides, right? Sure they do. But even so, to talk about a conspiracy in the United States, well, it's like being a person who spent a day upstairs alone writing poetry, steps out onto the corner to hand the poems out to passersby. You can imagine the looks he's going to get from people.
After the Supreme Court stopped the counting of votes, stopped the counting of votes, stopped the counting of votes, I sat by the upstairs window and looked out at the robins and the squirrels and the labradors and thought, of course they killed the Kennedys. They can do whatever they want. I thought about tossing a concrete block through the military recruiter's offices over in Sioux City just to put up some kind of resistance against all this. I even drove over there about an hour away to drive around the area and see how I might do it and get away. I asked others to join me. Nobody wanted in.
Then I drank a quart of beer out on the patio, sort of measured in both hands the weight of a concrete block against the piece of paper. I decided to keep writing. Don't know what good I can do. Maybe I'm just driving around just to be moving because I'm scared. Kurt Vonnegut once said that an anti-war novel is as likely to stop war as an anti-glacier novel is to stop glaciers. But you still gotta. You gotta walk out the back door, put yourself up against that ice, and push. Set your feet, lean, get your hands cold. Push with all your might till you got no push left. There are many of us who see the murder of the Iraqi people for gold as evil. Many who want their children to grow up in a world not perverted by the mind of Karl Rove. These are also human traits and desires. Join me. I'll be writing a column along the way.
I've got a license to drive slow, Nebraska plates. And now I remember how fast people in southeast Minnesota drive. They are busy people, getting things done, going places. I try not to get in the way. Sitting in heavy traffic on Broadway Avenue in Rochester, I kept an eye on the fat blonde woman behind me with no neck, driving the forest green Dodge Caravan. I had my hand on the auto lock in case she opened her door.
You know, once when I was a seminarian at the College of St. Thomas in St. Paul, 1979, I flipped a trucker the bird as I drove past him in my 1959 brown and white Chevy, just because I thought I could and get away with it. As I sang along with an Eagle song, I could see a familiar truck getting bigger in the rearview mirror. I had to stop. Trucker pulled up next to me, got out of his truck, came around to my door and pounded on the door and the window, saying, "Somebody should teach me a lesson." Well, I did learn a lesson. Don't stop.
Or if you have to stop, keep one eye on the lady in the fur-lined jacket in the side mirror. Anyway, I spoke last night to the Southeast Minnesota Peacemakers Group in Rochester, perhaps the most organized peace group in the continental USA. They have name tags and agendas and motions and seconds and non-acidic tea. In my talk, I raised the question of whether Senator Paul Wellstone was assassinated by the Bush government. I really didn't know what to expect in giving the talk in Minnesota. But during and afterwards, some said they agreed and some thanked me for saying out loud what was on people's minds. They were not aware of Jim Fetzer's book, American Assassination. And I said that an electromagnetic weapon was a possibility and told how the FBI was on the scene too soon not to have left Minneapolis before the plane crashed. And the fire burned blue-white, which is how an electrical fire burns. Those are things I found out by reading Fetzer's book. I have to admit out loud that a lot of what I say comes not from knowing exactly, but from feeling. I don't apologize for that.
I don't think there's anything wrong with saying what you feel, having your beating heart be your only document. I would actually like to have someone show me to my satisfaction that I'm wrong about Bush and 9/11, Bush and Wellstone. It'd be fine with me. To have to say the alternative, to have to say that persons within our own government did these things, well, it's not particularly easy to live with. I'd be glad to let it go. I first found out about Wellstone's death when I turned on my computer that day and went to Common Dreams, and there was Wellstone's photo. I then went over to run on the treadmill at the college. The Wellstone news was on the TV in the corner, and a couple of college girls were snickering, implying he got what he deserved. Gotta love those pro-lifers. The timing of the death of Wellstone was perfect for the Bush administration. They needed that seat to control the Senate. Wellstone stood in the way of a lot of things. Think how excited they would be at that time. 9/11 set up perfectly to run the table and take over the world. Would people like this let one guy away after all the work and struggle that they'd committed to become rich and powerful? Not likely.
Chuck?
Are you still hearing me?
I am. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm having phone problems and wasn't sure. There was an investigation. The National Transportation Safety Board determined that pilot error was responsible for the plane not maintaining adequate airspeed, which led to a stall, which they could not recover. So we can be certain that Wellstone was not murdered because the commission said he was not. I don't agree. I think these things can be rigged. The Warren Commission and the 9/11 Commission come to mind. I think someone like Wellstone, who had heart, who was twice the man, twice the human being that George W. Bush or Barack Obama are, he deserved better. He deserves justice. He deserves a real investigation. He deserves to not be forgotten.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO turkeys listening right now to your conversations from inside your freezer are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll continue to join us each and every week, starting with the next one. Same time, same place. And help us with our new American dream to build a better America and a better world where everyone can live together in peace. We'd like to thank WorldNewsTrust.com for hosting our websites, thespiritualun.org for sponsoring our show, and June2508.com, our longtime sponsor for this whole year. I'd like to thank all of you for coming to listen to us. I'd like to thank you, Mike, and good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Oh.